readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've just returned from a fabulous trip to Guatemala. A week of climbing huge ancient Mayan pyramids and attending ancient Mayan ceremonies still practiced today got me thinking. We really need to take a look into one of the most satisfying genres out there, ancient history told well. Popular writers such as Wilbur Smith, Colleen McCullough, and my very special guest today, Alice Hoffman, have all managed to help us make the leap across the centuries and civilizations by bringing us personal, human stories set against fascinating facts. There's so much to enjoy in really good historical novels. It's hard to narrow this selection to a few gems. But I'll assume you've already discovered classics such as I, Claudius, and instead focus on newer releases in this really robust genre. We'll trot all over Rome, Greece, and the Fertile Crescent. So let's set our time machine as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Wilbur Smith, one of the masters of historical fiction, takes us on a trip down the Nile in River God, a novel of ancient Egypt, a kingdom built on gold, a legend shattered by greed. The book opens on the eve of the festival of Osiris. Loyal subjects of Pharaoh have gathered in Thebes to pay tribute to their leader. But Taita, a wise eunuch slave, sees Pharaoh only as a symbol of the kingdom's fading glory. Beside Taita stand his protégés, Lostris, beautiful beyond her 14 years, and Tanis, a proud young army officer. Tanis and Lostris are deeply in love, but unbeknown to them, their union is an impossibility. Together, Taita, Lostris, and Tanis share a dream to restore the majesty of the pharaohs on the glittering banks of the Nile. Dick Hill narrates a grand tale of intrigue, deception, and love, firmly grounded in rich details that evoke burning days and sultry nights along the Nile.
The sky smoked with heat haze, and the sun beat down upon it all with the strokes of a coppersmith's hammer. In the mirage, the gaunt hills flanking the Nile seemed to tremble to the blows. Our boat sped close in beside the papyrus beds, near enough for the creaking of the water buckets of the shadouf on their long, counterbalanced arms to carry from the fields across the water. The sound harmonized with the singing of the girl in the bows. Lostris was 14 years of age. The Nile had begun its latest flood on the very day that her red woman's moon had flowered for the first time, a coincidence that the priests of Hapi had viewed as highly propitious. Lostris, the woman's name that they had then chosen to replace her discarded baby name, meant Daughter of the Waters. I remember her so vividly on that day. She would grow more beautiful as the years passed, become more poised and regal, but never again would that glow of virgin womanhood radiate from her so overpoweringly. Every man aboard, even the warriors at the rowing benches, was aware of it. Neither I nor any one of them could keep our gaze off her. She filled me with a sense of my own inadequacy and a deep and poignant longing, for although I am a eunuch, I was gelded only after I had known the joy of a woman's body. Taita, she called to me, sing with me. And when I obeyed, she smiled with pleasure. My voice was one of the many reasons that, whenever she was able, she kept me near her. My tenor complimented her lovely soprano to perfection. We sang one of the old peasant love songs that I had taught her, and which was still one of her favorites. My heart flutters up like a wounded quail when I see my beloved's face, and my cheeks bloom like the dawn sky to the sunshine of his smile. From the stern, another voice joined with ours. It was a man's voice, deep and powerful, but it lacked the clarity and purity of my own. If my voice was that of a dawn-greeting thrush, then this was the voice of a young lion. Lostris turned her head, and now her smile shimmered like the sunbeams on the surface of the Nile. Although the man upon whom she played that smile was my friend, perhaps my only true friend, still I felt the bitter gall of envy burn the back of my throat. Yet I forced myself to smile at Tanis, as she did, with love. Tanis's father, Pianki, Lord Herab, had been one of the grandees of the Egyptian nobility, but his mother had been the daughter of a free Tehenu slave. Like so many of her people, she had been fair-headed and blue-eyed. She had died of the swamp fever while Tanis was still a child, so my memory of her was imperfect. However, the old women said that seldom before had such beauty as hers been seen in either of the two kingdoms. On the other hand, I had known and admired Tanis's father, before he lost all his vast fortune and the great estates that had once almost rivaled those of Pharaoh himself. He had been of dark complexion, with Egyptian eyes the color of polished obsidian, a man with more physical strength than beauty, but with a generous and noble heart. Some might say too generous and too trusting, for he had died destitute, with his heart broken by those he had thought his friends, alone in the darkness, cut off from the sunshine of Pharaoh's favor. Thus it seemed that Tanis had inherited the best from both his parents, except only worldly wealth. In nature and in power he was as his father, in beauty as his mother. So why should I resent my mistress loving him? I loved him also, and, poor, neutered thing that I am, I knew that I could never have her for myself, not even if the gods had raised my status above that of slave. Yet such is the perversity of human nature that I hungered for what I could never have, and dreamed of the impossible.
That was River God by Wilbur Smith. From the spectacle of gladiators in combat to the intrigue of the Senate, from foreign wars that created an empire to betrayals that nearly tore it apart, The Gates of Rome by Con Iggulden tells the remarkable story of the man who would become the greatest Roman of them all, Julius Caesar. A titanic power struggle is about to shake the Roman Republic to its core. Citizen will fight citizen in a bloody conflict, and Julius Caesar will be in the thick of it all. Robert Glenister performs a book that is wonderfully enjoyable in its imagination and storytelling.
He could hear the boy laughing as he cramped and groaned, trying to curl into the pain. "There's a branch that will do. Tie their legs together and string them up to swing. We can see who's the best shot with javelins and stones." "Your father knows my father," Gaius spat out, as the pain in his stomach lessened. "True. Doesn't like him, though. My father is a proper patrician, not like yours. Your whole family could be his servants if he wanted. I'd make that mad mother of yours scrub the tiles." At least he was talking. The thug with the horsehair twine was intent on tying knots at Gaius's feet, ready to hoist him into the air. What could he say to bargain? His father had no real power in the city. His mother's family had produced a couple of consuls. That was it. Uncle Marius was a powerful man, so his mother said.
"We are nobilitas. My Uncle Marius is not a man to cross."
There was a sudden high-pitched yelp as the string over the branch went tight, and Marcus was swung into the air upside down.
"Tie the end of that stump. This fish next," Tonius said, laughing gleefully.
Gaius noted that the two friends followed his orders without question. It would be pointless trying to appeal to one of them.
"Let us down, you spot-covered pusbag!" Marcus shouted, as his face darkened with the rush of blood.
Gaius groaned. Now they would be killed, he was sure.
"You idiot, Marcus! Don't mention his spots. You can see he must be sensitive about them."
Suetonius raised an eyebrow, and his mouth opened in astonishment. The heavy-set boy paused as he threw the twine over the same branch as Marcus.
Oh, you have made a mistake, little fish. Finish stringing that one up, Decius. I'm going to make him bleed a little.
Suddenly the world tilted sickeningly, and Gaius could hear the twine creak and a low whistle in his ears as his head filled with blood. He rotated slowly and came round to see Marcus in a similar predicament. His nose was a little bloody from being knocked down the first time.
"I think you've stopped my nosebleed, Tonius. Thanks."
Marcus's voice trembled slightly, and Gaius smiled at his bravery. When he'd first come to live with them, the little boy had been naturally nervous and a little small for his age. Gaius had shown him around the estate, and they'd ended up in the hay barn, right at the top of the stack sheaves. They had looked down at the loose pile far below, and Gaius had seen Marcus's hands tremble.
"I'll go first and show you how it's done," Gaius had said cheerfully, launching himself feet first and whooping.
Below, he'd looked up at the edge for a few seconds, waiting to see Marcus appear. Just as he thought it would never happen, a small figure shot into the air, leaping high. Gaius had scrambled out of the way as Marcus crashed into the hay, winded and gasping.
"I thought you were too scared to do it," Gaius said to the prone figure, blinking in the dust.
"I was," Marcus had replied quietly. "But I won't be afraid. I just won't."
The hard voice of Suetonius broke into Gaius's spinning thoughts.
"Gentlemen, meat must be tenderized with mallets. Take your stations and begin the technique, like so."
He swung his stick at Gaius's head, catching him over the ear. The world went white, then black, and when he next opened his eyes, everything was spinning as the string twisted. For a while, he could feel the blows as Suetonius called out,
"One, two, three! One, two, three!"
He thought he could hear Marcus crying, and then he passed out, to the accompaniment of jeers and laughter. He woke and went back under a couple of times in the daylight, but it was dusk when he was finally able to stay conscious. His right eye was a heavy mass of blood, and his face felt swollen and caked in stickiness. They were still upside down and swinging gently as the evening breeze came in from the hills.
"Wake up, Marcus. Marcus."
His friend didn't stir. He looked terrible, like some sort of demon. The crust of crumbling river mud had been broken away, and there was now only a grey dust streaked with red and purple.
We've just listened to Gates of Rome by Con Eagleton. Warriors in life or literature have challenged their commanding officer and the rationale of the war they fought as fiercely as did Homer's hero Achilles. Today, the Iliad is celebrated as one of literature's greatest works, the epic of all epics, a tale read by every high schooler in the United States. Using the legend of the Trojan War, the Iliad addresses the central questions defining the war experience of every age. Is a warrior ever justified in challenging his commander? Must he sacrifice his life for someone else's cause? Giving his life for his country, does a man betray his family? How is a catastrophic war allowed to start, and why, if all parties wish it to be over, can it not be ended? In The War That Killed Achilles, the true story of Homer's Iliad and the Trojan War, Caroline Alexander lets us see why a familiar story has had such an impact on us for centuries. She seeks to reveal what Homer really meant. Written with the authority of a scholar and the vigor of a best-selling narrative, The War That Killed Achilles is performed by Michael Page.
When the Roman Empire split in the 6th century AD, knowledge of Greek, which flourished in Byzantium or the Eastern Empire, all but vanished in the West. The Iliad itself was forgotten, and in its stead stories about the war at Troy flourished, which, along with romantic sagas about Alexander the Great, formed the most popular classical material of the Middle Ages. The primary sources for these post-Homeric renderings of the matter of Troy, as the body of romance came to be called, were the Latin prose works of Dictys of Crete and Dares of Phrygia, dated to the 3rd and 5th or 6th centuries AD respectively, both of whom were fancifully believed to have been eyewitnesses to the Great War at Troy. In these Latin renderings, Achilles, the complex hero of Homer's Iliad, stripped of his defining speeches, devolved into a brutal, if heroically brave, action figure. In the hands of medieval writers, sentiment hardened further against him. The 12th century Roman de Troyes takes pains in 30,000 lines of French verse to ensure that Achilles is depicted as in all ways inferior, even in martial prowess, to the noble Trojan hero Hector. Such interpretive touches would remain potent down the ages, arguably into the present time. England, as late as the Elizabethan age, was largely Greekless, and the first translation of a substantial portion of the Iliad, 10 books, into the English language was made by way of a French text and published in 1581 by Arthur Hall, a member of Parliament until he suffered disgrace for, among other offences, sundry lewd speeches and debt. His translation flirts with doggerel. "And often shall the passers-by say, look who yonder is, the wife of valiant Hector, lo, who in the field with his such fame and great renown did get, when Grecians compassed round the great and mighty town of Troy and tore it to the ground." Then, between 1598 and 1611, George Chapman's landmark translation of the Iliad appeared, made from Greek and other texts and Latin translations, and was followed in 5 years by his translation of the Odyssey. It was the latter that, 200 years later, Keats, who did not know Greek, read and commemorated unforgettably in his sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer. "Much have I travelled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his demesne. Yet did I never breathe its pure serene till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortes when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien." The ice had been broken, and there is, since the late 16th century, hardly a generation in the English-speaking world which has not produced its Homers. But as knowledge of Homer was disseminated by English translations, as well as by knowledge of the original Greek, the perception of the Iliad's central hero, Achilles, shifted, and so accordingly did the perceived meaning of the epic. Not only had Achilles been tarnished by the medieval lays, but from the time of Augustan England of the 18th century, he was further diminished by the ascendancy of another ancient epic, Virgil's Aeneid, which related the deeds and fate of the Roman hero Pius Aeneas, Aeneas the Pious, the virtuous, dutiful, enthralled to the imperial destiny of his country. In contrast to this paragon of fascism, Achilles, who asserts his character in the Iliad's opening action by publicly challenging his commander-in-chief's competence, and indeed the very purpose of the war, was deemed a highly undesirable heroic model.
That was The War That Killed Achilles by Carolyn Alexander. My guest today, Alice Hoffman, has published 21 novels, including one of my all-time favorite books, The Ice Queen. Alice was born in New York, got her BA at Adelphi University, then received a fellowship to Stanford University Creative Writing Center, where she received an MA. She currently lives in Boston. Hoffman's first novel, Property Of, was written at the age of 21 while at Stanford. Since that remarkable beginning, Alice Hoffman has become one of our most distinguished novelists. Her novel, Here on Earth, an Oprah Book Club choice, was a modern reworking of some of the themes of Emily Bronte's masterpiece, Wuthering Heights. Practical Magic was made into a film starring Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman. Alice has also worked as a screenwriter and is the author of the original screenplay, Independence Day, a film starring Kathleen Quinlan and Diane Wiest. Her short fiction and nonfiction have appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe Magazine, the LA Times, Architectural Digest, and the Harvard Review, just to list a few. Hoffman has been at work on The Dove Keepers, which Toni Morrison calls a major contribution to 21st century literature, for the past 5 years. The story of the survivors of Masada is considered by many to be her masterpiece. Welcome, Alice. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Masada, 72 AD. What led you to write this story?
I went to visit Masada. I never expected to write about it, but I was really moved when I went up there in a way that I didn't expect to be. And then when I went home, I started reading Josephus, who's the only historian of the time, and I read that there had been survivors. And as soon as I read that, I knew that there was a novel I wanted to write.
You visited the site, and I'm assuming you spent a fair amount of time there. What were your experiences there? What did you feel?
Well, the first time I went, no one else was there. So it was a very hot August morning. It was about 105 degrees, and I guess no one else wanted to be there at that moment, and I was there with my family. And it was such an intense experience to be there in the silence. Because of that silence, I felt like I could hear the voices of the past.
That's amazing. It is a very magical place. The book is filled with so much detail, elements of daily life, the herbs used for medicine, social hierarchies, warriors. How did you do all the research?
You know, I really don't know, because there was so much I didn't know. And when I realized how much research there was to be done, I think somebody else might have quit. But I just kept going on, and I just decided I could research for the rest of my life, but instead I decided I just needed to know what my four women knew. I didn't need to know everything about the history, and I just, you know, basically did the best I could. But it was difficult finding out about domestic life. That was the biggest challenge.
So how much time did you spend researching before you actually put pen to paper?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it was a couple of months of researching, and then I realized I was getting really mired down in the research, and I'm not a historian, I'm not an academic, and I needed to start really writing. And then I would go back and forth and layer on more and more research. And then I was a visiting scholar at Brandeis University, so that was very helpful to have their libraries.
Oh, well, so many of us have visited Masada, but few realize there were any survivors. When you came across that story, I mean, you were just immediately moved to build your book around it.
Absolutely. I'm very interested in survivors. I'm always amazed how people are able to survive such intense sorrow and tragedy, and it's always such a miracle to me how people manage to do that. So I think for me it was kind of a study of how people could rise above all of this agony and sorrow and still be compassionate, kind human beings.
The book is the intertwining stories of four extraordinary women, Yael, Revka, Aziza, and Shira, each of whom came to Masada by a different path. How did you decide on their stories?
Here's the funny thing. They really decided on their own stories. When I read that two women and five children were survivors, but my story is in the voice of four women, so I wasn't quite sure which women would die and which would live. And that, for me, was part of the interest for me as a writer in writing the book. But I was definitely mistaken about who would live and who would die. They began to write their own stories and make their own fates.
Well, of course, this is ancient history, but yet you've made it so relevant to today. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, I wanted it to feel very modern, and I think they do feel like modern women, and I feel like this could be happening right now in a war-torn country, that there are always women who have to survive and who have to protect their children. And I do feel that, you know, they feel like our sisters when you read the book.
I think it's quite amazing that Masada is seen as a victory. What about this event has made it stand out as a beacon of courage rather than something very different?
Well, you know, Masada is a very complicated place, and there is the sense that, you know, the people who died rather than become enslaved by the Romans are heroes, and they are. But there also is the sense of the continuation of our people and the continuation of children's lives. And I think that those women were also heroes. So I think, you know, they're both heroic acts, and it just really, one doesn't cancel out the other.
Mm-hmm. Yael is, you start the book with Yael's story. She's so strong, yet kind of because of circumstances and her father and so on, very distant. How have your readers been reacting to her?
It's interesting because I personally didn't like her when I started to write about her, and I didn't know if I could write about a character I didn't like. But as I got to know her and understand her, my feelings about her completely changed. I mean, she's very, I think, more than any other character I've ever written, morally, she's very complicated. She does some terrible, horrible things. And yet, I think you still feel compassion for her. And in a way, I grew to love her.
She's strong, and I like her, too. I mean, I I guess what I liked about her so much is her survival, her surviving. When you write a book, and you've had some made into movies and screenplays and so on, and then many have been audio titles, how do other people performing your work and their interpretations, how do you feel about, I mean, how does that strike you?
Well, you know, usually when I finish a book, I'm finished with a book. So even though I've seen the films that were made of my books, and I haven't really listened very much. I've listened a little to the audio tapes, and I think they're fantastic. And the one for The Dove Keepers is really brilliant with four incredible actresses. But I usually don't listen to it because I really hear it in my own head the way I originally heard it when I wrote it.
Have you ever been in a situation where someone was interpreting your work and it was like, what are they doing?
Well, I think that happens when you deal with Hollywood. You know, you kind of give it up to other people to imagine, and then it becomes theirs and you're kind of sharing it with them.
You are getting such amazing press for this, from this book. Is it also been released in Hebrew, and what are the reactions been in Israel?
Well, it hasn't been released in Hebrew, so I don't know about the reactions in Israel other than my own family. And they've been really positive. And I feel like the Israelis that I know who have read it feel that I got the place. And that's really important to me, that they would feel that, you know, I described it the way that they sense it and the way they see it.
What do you want your readers to take away from this book?
You know, it's interesting because I want them to take away from it whatever they need to take away from it. But I realized after I finished the book that the book is about war, but it's also very much about forgiveness. And I'm hoping that it's kind of a lesson in forgiveness, not just for my readers, but also for me, because I think it's a very important lesson for all of us.
Yeah. Well, you're on a very exhausting book tour right now, so are you already working on your next project, or are you just kind of getting through this?
Well, I am. I'm working on a novel, and I have ideas for several other novels, but I tend not to talk about it because I have had the experience of finding, you know, half a novel in a you know, closet somewhere that I just, you know, I decided it wasn't working and I just abandoned it. So I'm always afraid that it won't work, and I can't really talk about it till it's done.
You've written 21 novels and countless short stories and other pieces. Sometimes when you're writing one of your works, do you feel that it's going to soar a little higher than the others? The Dove Keepers is getting such amazing reviews. Talk about that.
Well, I've never felt the same way that I feel about The Dove Keepers. I mean, for me, it's 40 years of practice led to my being able to write The Dove Keepers. And in a strange way, it feels like the most autobiographical of my books, even though it has nothing to do with my actual day-to-day life. Emotionally, it feels like it's the closest to me and kind of a map of my soul in a way. So I feel very, very close to this book. And for me, it's a very special book and very different.
Alice, this is one amazing book. I have many friends who are voracious readers, and either they're reading it now or they're begging to be number two on the book loan. So congratulations. And I have to say, you're one of my favorite authors, and I can't wait for your next piece.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
The Dove Keepers is the best-selling novel that draws upon Alice Hoffman's passion for archaeology, mythology, magic, and her inimitable understanding of women. In 70 CE, 900 Jews held out for months against armies of Romans on a mountain in the Judean desert, Masada. According to the ancient historian Josephus, two women and five children survived. I had never known that fact before. Based on this tragic historical event, Hoffman weaves a spellbinding tale of four extraordinary, bold, and resourceful women, each of whom had come to Masada by a different path. Yael's mother died in childbirth, and her father never forgave her for that death. Rivka, a village baker's wife, was forced to watch her daughter's brutal murder by Roman soldiers. Aziza is a warrior's daughter, raised as a boy, yet very much a woman with woman's passions. Shira is wise in the ways of ancient magic and medicine, a shaman atop the mountain. The lives of these four complex and fiercely independent women intersect in the desperate days of the siege as the Romans draw near. All are dove keepers, and all keep secrets about who they are, where they come from, what they live for, and what they die for. Aya Cash, Jessica Hett, and Tova Feldsha perform this remarkable book.
Tools signified weapons and could not be used in constructing the holiest of holy places. Therefore, the great warrior King David had been prohibited from building the temple because he had known the evils of war. Instead, the honor fell to his son, King Solomon, who called upon the Shamir, a worm who could cut through stone, thereby creating glory to God without the use of metal tools. The temple was built as God had decreed it should be, free from bloodshed and war. Its 9 gates were covered with silver and gold. There, in the most holy of places, was the ark that stored our people's covenant with God, a chest made of the finest acacia wood, decorated with 2 golden cherubs. But despite its magnificence, the first temple was destroyed, our people exiled to Babylonia. They had returned after 70 years to rebuild in the same place, where Abraham had been willing to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice to the Almighty, where the world had first been created. The second temple had stood for hundreds of years as the dwelling place of God's word, the center of creation in the center of Jerusalem, though the ark itself had disappeared, perhaps in Babylonia. But now, times of bloodshed were upon us once more. The Romans wanted all that we had. They came to us as they swarmed upon so many lands with their immense legions, wanting not just to conquer but to humiliate, claiming not just our land and our gold, but our humanity. As for me, I expected disaster, nothing more. I had known its embrace before I had breath or sight. I was the second child, a year younger than my brother, Amram, but unlike him entirely, cursed by the burden of my first breath. My mother died before I was born. In that moment, the map of my life arose upon my skin in a burst of red marks, speckles that, when followed one to the other, have led me to my destiny. I can remember the instant when I entered the world, the great calm that was suddenly broken, the heat of my own pulse beneath my skin. I was taken from my mother's womb, cut out with a sharp knife. I am convinced I heard my father's roar of grief, the only sound to break the terrible silence of one who is born from death. I myself did not cry or wail. People took note of that. The midwives whispered to one another, convinced I was either blessed or cursed. My silence was not my only unusual aspect, nor were the russet flecks that emerged upon my skin an hour after my birth. It was my hair, the deep blood-red color of it, a thick cap growing, as if I already knew this world and had been here before. They said my eyes were open, the mark of one set apart. That was to be expected of a child born of a dead woman, for I was touched by Malach Hamavet, the angel of death, before I was born, in the month of Av, on the Tisha B'Av, the 9th day, under the sign of the lion. I always knew a lion would be waiting for me. I had dreamed of such creatures ever since I could remember. In my dreams, I fed the lion from my hand. In return, he took my whole hand into his mouth and ate me alive.
That was Dove Keepers by Alice Hoffman. And you thought she only wrote about Australia. Next, we'll preview Colleen McCullough's Antony and Cleopatra.
Mark Antony, famous warrior and legendary lover, expects that he will be Julius Caesar's successor. But when Caesar is murdered, his 18-year-old nephew, Octavian, is named as heir. No one, least of all Antony, expects Octavian to last. But his youth and slight frame conceal a remarkable determination and a sharp strategic mind. Under Octavian's rule, the empire is divided, with Antony responsible for the fabulously rich East. There, Antony meets Cleopatra, who still mourns Caesar, her lover and father of her only son. Despite his marriage to Octavian's sister, Antony is fascinated by the Egyptian queen. Drawn together by grief, ambition, passion, and politics, they begin a very public love affair. The tension between Antony and Octavian, already simmering, soon threatens to erupt into war, and the rest, as they say, is history. Sneha Methan narrates.
Victory at Philippi had found Mark Antony without a viable strategy to put Octavian out of the power equation. For Antony was a force of nature, lusty, impulsive, hot-tempered, and quite lacking foresight. His personal magnetism was great, of that kind which draws men by virtue of the most masculine qualities, courage, an Herculean physique, a well-deserved reputation as a lover of women, and enough brain to make him a formidable orator in the house. His weaknesses tended to be excused, for they were equally masculine, the pleasures of the flesh and heedless generosity. His answer to the problem of Octavian was to divide the Roman world between them, with a sop thrown to Marcus Lepidus, high priest and owner of a large senatorial faction. 60 years of on-again, off-again civil war had finally bankrupted Rome, whose people, and the people of Italia, groaned under poor incomes, shortages of wheat for bread, and a growing conviction that the betters who ruled them were as incompetent as venal. Unwilling to see his status as a popular hero undermined, Antony resolved that he would take the lion's share, leave the rotting carcass to that jackal Octavian. So after Philippi, the victors had carved up the provinces to suit Antony, not Octavian, who inherited the least enviable parts, Rome, Italia, and the big islands of Sicilia, Sardinia, and Corsica, where the wheat was grown to feed the peoples of Italia, long since incapable of feeding themselves. It was a tactic in keeping with Antony's character, ensuring that the only face Rome and Italia saw would belong to Octavian, while his own glorious deeds elsewhere were assiduously circulated throughout Rome and Italia. Octavian to collect the odium, himself the stout-hearted winner of laurels, far from the center of government. As for Lepidus, he had charge of the other wheat province, Africa, a genuine backwater. Ah, but Marcus Antonius did indeed have the lion's share. Not only of the provinces, but of the legions. All he lacked was money, which he expected to squeeze out of that perennial golden fowl, the East. Of course, he had taken all three of the Gauls for himself, though in the West they were thoroughly pacified by Caesar and rich enough to contribute funds for his coming campaigns. His trusted marshals commanded Gaul's legions, of which there were many. Gaul could live without his presence. Caesar had been killed within 3 days of setting out for the East, where he had intended to conquer the fabulously rich and formidable kingdom of the Parthians, using its plunder to set Rome on her feet again. He had planned to be away for 5 years, and had planned his campaign with all his legendary genius. So now, with Caesar dead, it would be Marcus Antonius, Mark Antony, who conquered the Parthians and set Rome upon her feet again.
That was Antony and Cleopatra by Colleen McCullough. In James Carroll's provocative retelling of the deep past, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignites Our Modern World, we see the violence that threatened Jerusalem from ancient times. Centuries later, the mounting European fixation on a heavenly Jerusalem sparked both anti-Semitism and racial colonial contempt. The holy wars of the Knights Templar burned apocalyptic mayhem into the Western mind.
Carol's thought-provoking leap is to show how, as Christopher Columbus carried his own Jerusalem-centric worldview to the West, America, too, was powerfully shaped by the dream of the city on the hill, from Abraham Lincoln to Woodrow Wilson and on to Ronald Reagan. The nuclear brinksmanship of the 1973 Yom Kippur War seems to prove his point. Religion and violence fuel each other, and Jerusalem seems to be ground zero of the heat. The work is read by Mel Foster.
Later, the end of history sheds its religiosity, but Jerusalem remains at least implicitly the backdrop under which millennial images are thrown by social utopias, whether founded by pilgrims in the New World, by communards in Europe, or by communists. Ultimately, a continuous 20th and 21st century war against evil turns out, surprisingly, to be centered on Jerusalem, a pivotal point of both the Cold War and the War on Terror. Having begun as the ancient city of apocalypse, it became the magnetic pole of Western history, doing more to create the modern world than any other city. Only Jerusalem, not Athens, Rome, or Paris. Not Moscow or London, not Istanbul, Damascus, or Cairo, not El Dorado or the New York of immigrants' dreams, only Jerusalem occupies such a transcendent place in the imagination. It is the earthly reflection of heaven, but heaven, it turns out, casts a shadow. Thus, across the centuries, the fancied city creates the actual city, and vice versa. The more exalted the metaphoric status of Jerusalem, as the Jerusalem scholar Sidra Dekoven Ezrahi writes, the more dwarfed its geopolitical dimensions. The more expansive the boundaries of the holy city, the less negotiable its municipal borders. Therefore, war. Over the past two millennia, the ruling establishment of Jerusalem has been overturned 11 times, almost always with brute violence, and always in the name of religion. This book will tell the story of those wars, how sacred geography creates battlefields. Even when wars had nothing literally to do with Jerusalem, the city inspired them with the promise of the glory of the coming of the Lord. With his terrible swift sword, as put by one battle hymn from far away. Metaphoric boundaries obliterate municipal borders, with disputes about the latter spawning expansions of the former, even to distant reaches of the earth. Jerusalem fever infects religious groups, certainly the three monotheisms that claim the city. Although mainly a Christian epic, its verses rhyme with what Judeans once did, what Muslims took to, what a secular culture unknowingly pursues, and what parties to the city's contemporary conflict embody. Yet, if Jerusalem is the fever's chosen niche, Jerusalem is also its antidote. Religion, likewise, is both a source of trouble and a way of vanquishing it. Religion, one sees in Jerusalem as nowhere else, is both the knife that cuts the vein and the force that keeps the knife from cutting.
We've just heard a preview of Jerusalem, Jerusalem by James Carroll. Alexander the Great is considered one of the most successful commanders of all time. History records he was undefeated in battle. When asked to name other great military leaders, Caesar reportedly said, "Alexander was the only great one." Alexander the Great, Lessons from History's Undefeated General by Bill Yenny, spotlights his remarkable history. Born in 356 BC, the son of Philip II of Macedonia, Alexander the Great was educated by Aristotle, became a consummate horseman, and commanded a wing of his father's army in the victory over the Thebans and Athenians at the Battle of Chaeronea, all when he was still a teenager. By the time of his death at age 32, he had united Greece and had amassed an empire that stretched from the Adriatic Sea to the Indus River and included all of Persia and most of Egypt. He ruled as both the Shah of Persia and as a pharaoh of Egypt by right of conquest. he was also crowned King of Asia. The scope of his military prowess remains awe-inspiring to this day. Yeni's masterful biography, narrated by Paul Michael Garcia, shows Alexander's influence on the course of cultural and political history and sheds fascinating new light on his leadership, strategy, and his legacy.
Around midnight on the last day of September in 331 BC, on a mountain somewhere east of the modern Iraqi city of Mosul, a group of Macedonian officers took a walk. They went to the edge of a cliff to look out at the vast encampment of their enemy at a place called Gagamila. What they saw made their blood run cold. Writes Lucius Mestrius Plutarchus, better known as Plutarch, circa AD 46-120, in his Lives of Noble Greeks and Romans, "When they saw the plain between the Niphates and the Guardian Mountains all lighted up with the barbarian fires, while an indistinguishably mingled and tumultuous sound of voices arose from their camp as if from a vast ocean, they were astonished at their multitude and argued with one another that it was a great and grievous task to repel such a tide of war. Before them lay the enormous army of Darius III, the monarch of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, the greatest empire yet seen in the history of the world. Observers reported, and historians long believed, that the Macedonian officers gazed that night upon the campfires of a million-man army. Only 11 nights had passed since the Macedonians had looked into the sky and seen the most disturbing of omens. First, the moon lost its usual brightness, and then became suffused with a blood-red color which caused a general dimness in the light it shed," writes the 1st century AD historian Curtius, Quintus Curtius Rufus, of this lunar eclipse in his Historiae Alexandri Magni, or History of Alexander the Great. "Right on the brink of a decisive battle at Gagamila, the men were already in a state of anxiety, and this now struck them with a deep religious awe which precipitated a kind of panic." The Macedonian officers, though they were victorious veterans of two titanic field battles against the Persian army, thought that their time had run out. It was their belief that they were outnumbered by a factor of about 20-1, and that defeat awaited them in the coming battle. They went to the tent where their commander was relaxing, and nervously proposed that the only viable tactic against such an immense foe would be a surprise attack under cover of darkness. When their commander had heard them out, the 25-year-old Alexander of Macedonia looked up and replied. According to Plutarch, Alexander told them, "I will not steal my victory." By this he meant that he wished the coming battle to be decisive and conclusive. Alexander wanted there to be no doubt that Darius had been beaten, fair and square, and in broad daylight for all to see. That night, in the light of his own fire, Alexander calmly projected the confidence of a man who had no doubt of his victory the following day. 3 years earlier, as he was preparing for his unprecedented campaign against the Persian Empire, the priestess at the Oracle of Delphi had told him, "Thou art invincible, my son." She was right. He was never defeated in battle.
We've just heard Alexander the Great by Bill Yenny. The devastating struggle to the death between the Carthaginians and the Romans was one of the defining dramas of the ancient world. In an epic series of land and sea battles, both sides came close to victory before the Carthaginians finally succumbed, and their capital city, history, and culture were almost utterly erased. Drawing on a wealth of new archaeological research, Richard Miles, in his Carthage Must Be Destroyed, The Rise and Fall of an Ancient Civilization, vividly brings to life this lost empire. From its origins among the Phoenician settlements of Lebanon, to its apotheosis as the greatest sea power in the Mediterranean.
And at the heart of the history of Carthage lies the extraordinary figure of Hannibal, the scourge of Rome, one of the greatest military leaders, but a man who also unwittingly led his people to catastrophe. Carthage Must Be Destroyed reintroduces modern listeners to the larger-than-life historical players in the ancient glory of this almost forgotten civilization. Grove Gardner narrates this epic history of a doomed civilization and a lost empire.
The soldiers proceeded with caution, as the nature of the hill made it an excellent terrain from which to stage ambushes. Three narrow streets led up the steep slopes. Each was flanked by six-story houses from whose roofs their inhabitants mounted a desperate last defense by raining missiles down onto the advancing legionaries. However, Scipio, a seasoned siege tactician, quickly regained the momentum by commanding his troops to storm the houses and make their way to the roofs. From there, they used planks to create gangways over to the adjacent houses. While this battle raged above, the slaughter on the streets continued. Once the resistance on the roofs had been neutralized, Scipio ordered that the houses be set alight. So that his troops' progress up the hill should be unimpeded, he also commanded that cleaning parties should keep the streets clear of debris. However, it would not be just stone and burning timber that came crashing down from above, but also the bodies of children and the elderly who had been sheltered in secret hiding places within the buildings. Many, although injured and horribly burnt, were still alive, and their piteous cries would add to the cacophony around them. Some were subsequently crushed to death by the Roman cavalry proceeding up the streets. Others would meet a far more gruesome end as the street cleaners dragged their still-breathing bodies out of the way with their iron tools before tossing both the living and the dead into pits. For 6 long days and nights, the streets of Carthage were consumed by this hellish turmoil, with Scipio conserving the physical strength and sanity of his men by regularly rotating his killing squads. Then, on the 7th day, a delegation of Carthaginian elders bearing olive branches from the sacred temple of Eshmun as a sign of peace came to beg the Roman general that their lives and those of their fellow citizens be spared. Scipio acceded to their request, and later that day 50,000 men, women, and children left the citadel through a narrow gate in the wall into a life of miserable slavery. Although the vast majority of its surviving citizenry had surrendered, Hasdrubal, his family, and 900 Roman deserters, who could expect no mercy from Scipio, still held out. They took refuge in the Temple of Eshmun, which, because of its lofty and inaccessible position, they were able to defend for some time. Eventually, lack of sleep, physical fatigue, hunger, and terror forced them onto the roof of the building, where they made a final stand. It was now that Hasdrubal's nerve broke. Deserting his comrades and family, he secretly made his way down and surrendered to Scipio. The sight of their general groveling in supplication at the feet of his Roman nemesis merely hardened the resolve of the remaining defenders to die a defiant death. Cursing Hasdrubal, they set fire to the building and died in the flames. It would be Hasdrubal's own wife, with her terrified children cowering at her side, who would deliver the final damning verdict on her disgraced husband. "Wretch," she exclaimed, "traitor, most effeminate of men, this fire will entomb me and my children. Will you, the leader of great Carthage, decorate a Roman triumph? Ah, what punishment will you not receive from him at whose feet you are now sitting?" She then killed her children and flung their bodies into the fire before throwing herself in after them. After 700 years of existence, Carthage was no more.
That was a preview of Carthage Must Be Destroyed by Richard Miles. Let's end with a wonderful classic recently updated. In Temples, Tombs, and Hieroglyphs, A Popular History of Ancient Egypt, Barbara Mertz highlights her lifelong enthusiasm for ancient Egypt. Her love of the subject is contagious and makes her the perfect guide to ancient Egypt for the student, the layman, and those who plan to visit or have visited the Nile Valley. The reader reviews for this title were off the charts, glowing as brightly as the noonday sun in the Egyptian desert. Let's listen as Lorna Raver narrates.
We will encounter the darker aspects of the human spirit as well as its bright triumphs. Yet never again, perhaps, will we see the human animal take a step so gigantic as this first one, little known and poorly recorded as it is. Scholars usually place the first revolution in man's way of life between the Paleolithic and Neolithic eras. These terms, which mean Old Stone Age and New Stone Age, were coined to describe a change in the techniques of working stone implements. But it is the least significant of the differences between the two periods. The wandering hunters of the Old Stone Age became the farmers and shepherds of the Neolithic. The permanent settlement of a tribe implies agriculture and domesticated animals, and perhaps pottery, though there is considerable variation from place to place, and people continued hunting and fishing even after other means of food production were developed. The evidence of the transitional period in the Nile Valley is almost non-existent, so far. One suspects that something is bound to turn up eventually, but perhaps not in the Nile Valley itself. There were hunter-gatherers wandering around the western desert, and possible signs of at least semi-permanent habitation there as early as 9,000 years ago. For our purposes, however, the oldest known pre-dynastic cultures of Egypt date from approximately 5400 BC. Life in the early village cultures was not exactly luxurious. The houses were built of mud and sticks and consisted of a single dark room, unfloored and unventilated except for a smoke hole in the roof. The bodies of the dead were laid in shallow holes scooped in the sand, with no covering except straw mats or skins. But in the goods buried with them, we may see the groping of the human spirit toward the concept of immortality. They could only postulate a continuance of the life they knew. So the hunter has his spear, the woman her beads, vanitas vanitatum, against the fleshless skull, and the pitiful child bones sometimes huddle against the dust of a once cherished toy. The bones and their belongings can speak to us, sometimes with poignant clarity, and the mute stone and baked clay can speak as well to those who know how to listen. So meager are the remains from this distant time, before the dawn of history, that archaeologists have developed ingenious techniques for wringing the greatest possible amount of information from each scrap. They rely upon the skills of many specialists. Biologists who can identify the species of the gnawed bones in the kitchen middens, geochemists who analyze pottery, and paleobotanists who ponder the withered grains left in the bottom of the granary basket by a thriftless ancient housewife. Contrary to popular report, none of the mummy seeds found in Egypt has ever produced a living plant. There is a limit to the preservative qualities of even Egyptian soil. Most of the archaeological evidence from prehistoric Egypt comes from graves. There are a few village sites and also the kitchen middens, an archaeological euphemism for garbage dumps. The prehistoric equivalents of beer cans and melon rinds are fish and animal bones, worn-out flint tools, and scraps of broken pottery. There must have been settlements of some sort near these ancient garbage dumps, but not many have survived. From these scanty remains, Egyptologists have defined a number of pre-dynastic cultures, interrelated, but each having its own typical assemblage, the collection of objects produced and used by the people of a given culture. In this period, such an assemblage might include flint weapons, beads and amulets, baskets, and pottery.
That was Temples, Tombs, and Hieroglyphs by Barbara Mertz. Readers, thanks for journeying with me down the Nile and around the Med. As I mentioned, I'm just back from Central America. I have to say, I looked really hard for some recent well-reviewed titles about the Maya. I just couldn't find any. Unless the authors were writing about the end of time in 2012 or extraterrestrials, which I believe really denigrate a magnificent civilization. Can you help me in this quest with some title suggestions? Drop me a line at the Reader's Corner on bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me, and let's do it again next week.
on The Book Report.